this idea that in Canadian history, we've got this repeated pattern of doing things like this. You know, right from the beginning, we have broken treaty promises with we have residential schools, the imposition of the Indian Act. You know, slavery was legal for 200 years in Upper and Lower Canada. There was a head tax to prevent Chinese immigration. There was the internment of Ukrainians in World War I and Germans, Italians, Japanese in World War II. So we've seen different groups of people in Canada, different minority groups being singled out for this prejudicial, discriminatory treatment. And then, you know, over time, they kind of mostly, I think, end up kind of begrudgingly accepted into the mainstream idea of what a Canadian looks like or what a Canadian, you know, how a Canadian sounds or how a Canadian behaves. The first of my ancestors to come to Canada came from Italy about 100 years ago. And some of their experiences were not always easy. And then, you know, you look at the situation for Italian Canadians today, it's obviously very different. So there's this idea that we keep doing this to groups of people. We keep putting them through this and saying, okay, well, you guys are different. You're not like us. And then, you know, eventually I think we realize that, that they are. And we look back on some of these instances, like the internment of Japanese Canadians in World War II, and we can identify those as injustices. But because we can identify them as injustices, we should be well placed to identify those same attitudes taking place today and be able to do something about it. What I'm saying is that in 2019, we're ready to be better. We're ready to stop doing this gauntlet routine. We're ready to address this Islamophobia, for example, that's taking place right now and deal with it faster because it's unbecoming. This isn't what we're supposed to be about anymore.
So in your studies, is the Islamophobia that we're seeing right now as we're experiencing it in Canada, is it different from the experiences of racism that other groups of people have had to deal with?
Well, I think that it's similar. You know, I listed a bunch of them a minute ago, and I think you could definitely draw parallels in terms of the kind of attitudes that motivate it.
What do you think that this says about us as Canadians? You address this in the book that we have to deal with some of the mythology about ourselves here.
Yeah. So I am an optimist. I believe that we're ready to live up to those ideals of what Canadians are supposed to be all about. I think they've been a little bit aspirational in the past. I think they've maybe been a little bit rosier than our real track record should credit us. But I think that the majority of Canadians, when they would look at Islamophobia the way that I've laid it out on this book, these various episodes, and kind of take a step back and say, okay, what picture does this paint? I think most people would say, oh, that's not what we stand for, actually.
So how much of the racism that we're seeing right now towards Muslims, how much of it had to do with the events of September 11th, 2001, do you think?
Well, there was, you know, certainly significant Islamophobia prior to then. You know, this is something that, you know, we used to have kind of a, you know, race-based immigration policy in the past, you know, certain countries being preferred or non-preferred or where immigration was banned entirely, you know, and then later on there was, you know, some significant Islamophobia surrounding the first Gulf War. But you know, 9/11 definitely marked a turning point. And I think what we've seen when you look at, for example, when all of a sudden there's a spike in hate crimes, it often has coincided with some big international event, like maybe some of the attacks in Paris, for example, that happened a few years ago. There's often kind of a corresponding backlash here.
So, and what about the treatment of Muslim women in Canadian society? That's something that you got into, like, in various places throughout the book. Is there a different kind of discrimination against Muslim women than there are against Muslim men?
Yeah. So what, you know, some of the academics and experts that I interviewed were able to identify is that we kind of have two simultaneous stereotypes at play here. We are imagining Muslim men to be barbaric and dangerous, and we're imagining Muslim women to be meek and oppressed and in need of saving.
You spent a lot of time in your book, too, looking back at the 2015 election and specifically attempts by conservatives to use wedge politics related to Muslims to win the election. To what extent do you think were they successful and not successful?
Well, that's a really interesting question. You're talking about the 2015 election?
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, obviously, they were not successful in the sense that they didn't, you know, they didn't win. You know, they didn't win the election. The way I interpret this is that, you know, they took a position, a very public position, particularly on banning women wearing niqabs from participating in citizenship ceremonies. But there were other things in the campaign as well, like you know, this barbaric cultural practices hotline that they wanted to establish. They took these positions, and then you know, on the one hand, you had the Liberals and the NDP coming out against those positions. And then the question is, I think, why was Thomas Mulcair and the NDP punished and the Liberals were kind of rewarded? So my take on this is that there was a lot of strategic voting going on in 2015, and you had a lot of people who were not sure whether they should be voting Liberal or NDP in order to prevent a Conservative government. I think that was the calculus a lot of people were making. And so they were waiting to see which party would end up in a better place to defeat the Conservatives. And when Trudeau and Mulcair took that position, Mulcair's Quebec numbers fell a lot. And when his Quebec numbers fell a lot, that caused the national number to dip a little bit. And when that number dipped a little bit, then it kind of looked like, okay, so the Liberals are the ones to back in order to beat the Conservatives. And I think that he fell in Quebec, whereas Trudeau didn't, just because I think Quebecers were not as familiar with the NDP and the kind of what I would see as a predictable position for them to take. I don't think that was as predictable to Quebecers. Quebecers kind of had an idea of where the Liberals would land on that question, but the NDP was kind of like a newer entity.
So do you attribute the failure of Conservatives to gain power, did that have anything to do with the dog whistle, anti-immigration, racist kind of tropes that some of their people were expressing?
I mean, I think it's complex. I think that, you know, after a decade in power, you know, people are going to vote based on a bunch of different things. There were a lot of different perceptions about the government and about the opposition parties that would have motivated voter behavior. The polls showed that the niqab ban was popular. Something like maybe 80% of Canadians at one point, I think, might have supported it. And when you look at as well the popular vote, the Conservative numbers didn't fall that much, actually. So I don't know that we could draw that broad a conclusion.
Right. Now, your book was pretty close to still being at the printers when the federal election was called this time around, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what would you add to your book today if you could add another chapter now, which takes this federal election into account?
Well, what I thought was really interesting about this federal election is that to me, it looks like people who are sort of spouting racism and prejudice, it looked like they had a lot more momentum than it turned out they actually had. You know, they were quite comfortable with, you know, anti-immigrant billboards. There was a minor political party, you know, that was calling for Canada to maintain a European descended majority. You know, I heard reports of people writing swastikas on lawn signs, and there was that, you know, famous incident of Jagmeet Singh being, you know, accosted by someone saying, oh, you know, you should take off your turban because you'll look more Canadian. So the election kind of had this potential for a massive culture war showdown, and I would say that didn't really materialize. I think 2015 was, you know, maybe bigger in terms of identity politics. The climate was probably a bigger issue this time around. I think what's interesting is that, so, you know, what I would add to the book, I guess, is that the election showed that, you know, skin color, for example, was not a barrier to Jagmeet Singh achieving the sort of regular NDP results. He had an upsurge in momentum at the end. He got more seats than Jack Layton did in his first go around as NDP leader. He got more seats than Tommy Douglas ever did. So I think that the people who were spouting the kind of racism and prejudice at the beginning, that the people that I think maybe thought they had some momentum, I hope that they will see this as a stinging rebuke to their views. You know, not that we should, you know, go overboard in self-congratulating on you know, post-racism. Obviously, there's been some high-profile incidents recently that show just how much it's ingrained, even in well-intentioned people. But where I think the election of Donald Trump in the States showed us that sort of a certain portion of the discourse is kind of like maybe deeper and wider than we knew. We know a little bit more about that portion of the discourse here in Canada. And, you know, it maybe looks kind of the same, but it's a lot more lonely.
So what kind of responsibility do politicians have now for setting a different tone?
Huge, I think. I think that people take a lot of their cue from politicians about what is acceptable. What's acceptable to sort of say and believe about, you know, Canada as the cultural mosaic that it is. I think as well that you know, politicians, of course, are interested in being reelected, so they're interested in you know, mimicking what they hear from us. So similarly, we have a responsibility to show politicians that, you know what, no, there isn't payoff for xenophobic rhetoric or policies. The real political capital is to be gained by talking about the things that the majority of Canadians believe, which is, you know, I think something a lot nicer.
And also the role of social media, as that's been growing, there also seems to be a growth of a lot of these attitudes, too. Do you think that social media has a lot to do with it, or is that just a convenient scapegoat?
Well, definitely people are a little braver on social media in expressing themselves in nasty ways. You know, sometimes you'll hear, like, you know, threats of violence or whatever. And I'm pretty sure those people wouldn't dream of saying that stuff to somebody's face. So social media has that characteristic. I think as well, it's been a useful force in terms of, you know, galvanizing, you know, what I would see as maybe more positive responses.
As you look back at all of your research and the things that you found out, what gives you hope in the current climate that things can be turned around?
There's a lot, actually, that you know, that gives me hope. I talk in the book about a few of these examples. I think maybe one of the most beautiful is there was a guy who a Muslim guy. He looked every inch the stereotype that an Islamophobe would fear. Okay, and he blindfolds himself. He stands on a street corner in Toronto, and he has a sign around his a sign on him that says something like, "I am Muslim. I trust you. Do you trust me? Give me a hug." And he stands there blindfolded, and people just keep coming up to him and giving him hugs. And so the way I see it, it's this lovely gesture of common humanity that Canadians literally greeted with open arms. And a story like that, I believe, represents who we really are.
And what kinds of things, conversely, what produces the uneasiness and the feeling that it's like this is really going to be an ongoing problem for a long time?
Well, yeah, you know, there's a lot. And, you know, every time that you hear a story of, you know, a hate crime, whether it's a mosque being vandalized or, you know, a Muslim person in the streets being, yelled at or worse, being physically attacked. I mean, those stories obviously are extremely, troubling. And, I think that what we can do is the rest of us in society the majority of us who don't think that way, we need to be really, really loud and clear and make the people who would engage in that kind of activity really know that we are not on their side.
I usually ask this question at the beginning of an interview, but I wanted to save this so that we could sum it all up. Now that the book is done and it's out there, what are you hoping that the book will do and accomplish?
So what I hope is that it will kind of call out this Islamophobia that exists in our society so that people are aware of it. You know, I think, you know, really politically engaged people have not really put it together yet that, you know, that it exists. Once we know that it exists, I'm convinced that people will say, that doesn't represent us, that doesn't represent our values, and then do something about it. You know, we've got lots of examples of injustice in our history. We're really good, I think, at looking at something like, you know, the internment of Japanese Canadians in World War II and identifying that as an injustice. So if we can do that, we should be able to identify the same attitudes taking place in our society today and do something about it faster so that people don't have to read about it in a history book. And I firmly believe that in 2019, we're ready to do that.
And what does doing something about it look like? Can you give us some practical suggestions here?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of concrete things that we could do. You know, for example, we could bolster hate crime units on police forces. We could give people more avenues to report hate crimes. We could insist that police forces report more comprehensively on what hate crimes are reported to them and what they investigate. We could hire more Muslim police officers. There could be more oversight for security agencies. Security agencies themselves could put more focus on white supremacist hate groups, which are statistically a greater threat. And then, you know, more broadly, we need to interact with each other. We need to build friendships as opposed to retreating into silos. As a society, I think we need to understand Islam better. My generation, my parents' generation, we learned next to nothing about it in school. And, you know, I think it would help if we understood better, you know, what it has brought society and why it's so special to so many people, because, you know, prejudice obviously takes root in ignorance.
Okay, so can you tell us where we can find your book and where anyone can order it?
Sure. It's available from Knightwood Editions. That's the publisher in British Columbia. And, you know, it's certainly available at Chapters and at your, you know, local independent bookstores.
Is there anything else we haven't covered that you'd like to bring up?
I mean, I would say that I would like to add that, you know, that this book is a product of a number of years of research and some interviews with some really knowledgeable people. Including some of the most respected Muslim Canadian advocates and politicians, media and legal experts. So I think that's an important thing to know about it. The foreword was written by Ihsan Gardi, who's the former executive director of the National Council of Canadian Muslims. So he's a pretty credible voice. So I was really honored to have his support for the project. And generally, it sounds like people are seeing it as a useful addition to the conversation. I think it's important for non-Muslim people like me to engage in that kind of self-scrutiny.
In 2015, in Peterborough, an arsonist attacked the local mosque an hour after community members had been inside celebrating the birth of a baby boy. It wasn't the first time the mosque had been targeted. After 9/11, the windows had been smashed and local churches had raised money to help replace them. This time, though, the fire caused over $80,000 in damage. That was a lot to expect people to donate. Within a couple of days, the full amount had been raised and donations kept coming in. After the total had reached over $100,000, the mosque had to ask the public to stop. Let us prove that this open-hearted generosity is the real Canada. Let us ensure that our response to fear and hate always embodies that spirit. Some shameful and crass responses to tragedies have been banged out anonymously on the keyboards across the country. But the most liked comment on the CBC web article reporting on the fire at the Peterborough Mosque was different. The five simple words are penitent, yet imbued with a steely determination. We are better than this.
Was Victoria Fenner, former Rabble Radio host, and Graham Truelove, author of Un-Canadian, Islamophobia in the True North, in conversation back in 2019. We have a bunch of really special interviews like this one in our archives that are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Rabble.ca, which we encourage you to check out. And of course, remember to like, share, and subscribe. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Let's jump right in. This week, Doreen Nickel shares insights from a Senate Committee on Social Affairs, Science, and Technology, which has been studying Canada's temporary and migrant workforce. Independent Senator Ratna Omduvar, who was on the committee of the study, told Nickel that at the end of the interview phase of the study, she got the understanding that workers were prepared to accept subpar working conditions in order to eventually obtain permanent residency. Niger Saravia, organizer with Migrant Workers Alliance for Change, agrees. He says, quote, "The temporary foreign worker program has been designed to give the corporation maximum power to exploit migrant workers while depriving them of the ability to assert their rights and obtain services that Canadian society enjoys," end quote. The Senate will now move into a reflection phase with their final report, expected to be made public in March 2024. Also this week, Rabble columnist Kathy Crow argues the City of Toronto continues to exhibit mediocrity in its response to homelessness. In her column this month, she shares a written copy of the presentation she gave to the students in the Master's Journalism program at Toronto Metropolitan University. The presentation outlines the city's woefully inadequate services and lack thereof for homeless people in Toronto. "This is a humanitarian disaster," Crow argues. "We need action now." And finally, join us for Off the Hill this month. Next week, our Off the Hill panel, co-hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies, is tackling the affordable housing crisis in Canada. Guests this month include NDP MP Matthew Green, Alex Hemingway, senior economist for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, Acorn spokesperson Tanya Burkhart, and Rabble's parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg. Visit our website to sign up and join us on Zoom on October 18th at 4:30 p.m. Pacific, 7:30 p.m. Eastern. To read the full versions of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
Are you interested in radio, community-based media? You can join CJSF 90.1. We're a volunteer-run community radio station, and we always have space for new volunteers to become programmers, review music, edit audio, and so much more. All the training is provided, and anyone can join. To volunteer, email our volunteer coordinator, Noelle, at vol_4_cjsf@sfu.ca. Again, that's vol_4_cjsf@sfu.ca. Or you can visit our website, cjsf.ca. It's CJSF 90.1, diverse, independent, and yours.